Well, good evening. We have a new face tonight. So glad you could come. Let's do introductions around.
Julian.
Richard.
Dan.
Chris.
Mary
Ellen.
Wendy.
You've been in the Wednesday group.
Yes.
This happens often. It goes back and forth a little bit. This is a little more formal, as you can see. Quite a bit more formal. But it's basically the same. Yeah. We're studying. We have a study, a very informal kind of study. And this is the words of a very ancient teacher in Zen from Japan. And it's a nice one tonight about his teacher, his old teacher, Ju Qing. What we do is pass the book around and each one reads a paragraph. So, you want to start, Julian?
Sure. What number are we on?
25. 49?
Yes.
Here are my glasses.
He also said, when I was studying in the meditation cloister of Tianzhong in China, the elder Zhi Qing soon used to sit in meditation until about 11:30 at night and rose in the morning from about 2:30 to sit in meditation. We sat together with the elder in the monk's hall. There was no relaxing, even for one night.
During that time, many monks fell asleep. The elder walked around hitting sleeping monks with his fist, sometimes taking off his slipper to strike them with, shamming and exhorting them, awaking them from their sleep. If they still slept, he would go to the hall of illumination and ring the bell, call the servants to light the lamps, and give an impromptu general talk, such as,
since you have gathered in a monk's hall, what is the use of idly sleeping? Why then have you left your homes and entered a monastery? Have you not seen the sovereigns and officials of the world? Who among them takes life easy? The Lord masters the kingly way, and the ministers fulfill loyalty and integrity, and so on down to the peasants who cultivate the fields, wielding the hoe. Who passes easily through the world? Having entered a monastery to avoid all this, if you pass the time in vain, after all, what will be the use? The matter of life and death is a great one. Impermanence is swift. The doctrinal schools and the meditation schools alike exhort us in this way. Tonight, tomorrow, one may meet any kind of death. One may suffer any kind of illness. As long as you are alive for the time being, it is foolish not to carry out the way of the Buddha instead of passing the time in vain by lying down and sleeping. It is for this reason that the Buddha's teaching is declining. When the Buddha's teaching was flourishing everywhere, in all the monasteries they concentrated on sitting in meditation. In recent times, because they do not encourage sitting meditation everywhere, the Buddha's teaching is running thin.
I saw with my own eyes how he admonished the congregation of monks with such reasoning, and made them sit and meditate. Students of the present day, too, should think about his manner.
Also, one time his attendants who waited on him close by said to him, "The monks in the monks' hall are sleepy and tired, and may become sick, or their wills may flag. Perhaps this may be due to the long period of sitting. How would it be to shorten the time period for that sitting meditation?"
Everybody's wish.
The elder was very indignant, he said. "It should not be so. When those who lack the mind of the way tarry idly in a monk's hall, even were it for just a little while, they would still fall asleep. If they have the mind of the way and a will to accomplish its practice, the longer the time, the more they would rejoice in cultivating it. One last paragraph. Okay, I'll read it. When I was young, as I traveled to see the elders of various regions, a certain elder admonished me in this fashion. Previously, I would beat sleeping monks so hard my fist would almost break, but now I am old and my strength has faded, so that since I cannot beat them hard, no more good monks appear. It is because the elders of the various regions are lax in encouraging sitting meditation that the Buddha's teaching has declined. I should hit harder. Well, that explains a lot.
I'd like to volunteer as your muscle.
I thought you'd say how lucky you are that you were here, not there. I carry that little stick in sesshin, and people are always afraid I'm going to hit them with it. This was a time when Buddhism was at very, very low ebb in China, when Dogen went there. And he was looking for a teacher, and it took him a long time to find one because most of the temples were really not taking the practice seriously. And so he's addressing all of that in here. He saw that with his own eyes. And then when he finally found a teacher who was slapping them around with a slipper, I thought that was a nice way of doing it, with a slipper. He realized that there was someone serious about meditation rather than just the form. You can do all kinds of ceremonies and look pretty important and pretty fancy, but if the meditation practice isn't there, then there's no foundation for anything else. It was that kind of meeting that I've been reading about in the Sandokai essays that I've been reading, where a student and a teacher meet and recognize each other. It's, as Deshi Maru says, it's the essence of Zen, that sitting alone isn't enough, that meeting a teacher is the important part of it, that otherwise the student doesn't have anywhere to go with it. And having met the teacher, there's nobody to go with anything, anywhere. But in order to know that, you have to meet. So Dogen was very fortunate that he finally met Zhu Qing. And he actually had a flash of enlightenment when he was in that temple, when the monk next to him was being whacked with a slipper, and the teacher said, "You lazy bum, why don't you stay awake?" And Dogen suddenly went, okay. And it changed his whole life. He went to China because he had been trained in monasteries since he was a boy. And they kept teaching that all beings have Buddha nature. And he kept asking his teachers, if all beings have Buddha nature, why are we doing this practice? What's the point? And they couldn't answer. So he took his question on a very dangerous journey, extremely dangerous. He had to cross the China Sea, which was one of the more tumultuous pieces of water, in a tiny little wooden boat. 500 years ago. It's a very pressing question. If you let a question like that really penetrate, you have to go and find out. in China to this day, in Taiwan, and here up north outside of the town, I can never remember, Ukiah. There's an old insane asylum that's been beautifully redone as a Chinese monastery, Zen monastery. Really interesting and very impressive. It's called the 10,000 Buddhas. They have a little restaurant there where you all kinds of very interesting, totally vegetarian food. Lots of noodles and soups, and it's really good. And those people practice this kind of practice, 11 to 2, to sleep. In fact, some of them sleep, just sit up all night, and they have a stick with a chin holder so that as you're sitting, your head is held up. So if you do doze off, you don't fall over. And that's really intense. And way beyond what I was taught, even though we did sesshin, retreats were pretty strict, but you could come and go as you wanted to. Nobody came and got you out of bed. And if it was too much and you got tired, you just went to your bed and went to sleep. Koban always thought that somehow the wrong idea got mixed up in Buddhism in this way, and that because people became so passionate about the practice that they turned it into a kind of what in Buddhist time was called a tapas practice, the practice of pushing the body so hard and the mind, trying to squeeze it so hard that it somehow would transform. If we can only sleep 1 hour a night, maybe we will transform and become some better thing. And Buddha's experience was that that didn't work. He dropped that whole attitude, that whole dream and hope and wish, and returned to the ground with a wish to see how things really were, not the ideal, but the actuality. So when I first started to sit, there were a bunch of people who were very keen to sit, passionate about it, and hurt their knees. Actually, one person hurt her hip permanently because she said, I'm just going to sit these 7 days and not move, no matter what. And she didn't move, but she ended up with a hip that never did correct itself. So it doesn't make sense. But it leaves us with this, our everyday life in the world, with practice as a mighty part of our life, having to constantly balance it. There's nobody in a monastery telling us how long to practice or where to practice or when. We have to make it all up ourselves. And that's a challenge. It's a challenge if we have busy lives, and it's a challenge if we don't have busy lives. One reason it's nice to sit together is because we encourage and support each other. If we're just sitting at home, it's harder to find that support in oneself. Though actually that's the best. The best is to find it, and then you can sit anywhere. And when you're not sitting, just be mindful driving the car and typing on the computer and all those other things that we do. It takes real hard practice to get into that. But as Suzuki Roshi says, it feels like it's hard, but actually underneath there's something very sweet, something very tender that we keep recognizing and returning to. So I'm not going to hit you with my fist. I'm not going to do it. I promise. Cross my heart. I don't think we need to do that. But I will encourage you. I hope you all go for the session and really do it as much as you possibly can. Because it's such a gift, not only to you, yourself, but to your world. As you know. Are there questions? Ritu?
In the beginning you're talking about meeting a teacher, it's important to meet a teacher. Can you talk more about what that means, meeting?
We just chanted the Heart Sutra, in which we declared that form doesn't differ from emptiness, and emptiness doesn't differ from form. So it's about that, that we ourselves are form emptiness. Everything that we meet is form emptiness. And as human being, that situation, that condition, you could say, of human being has an opportunity to clarify itself so that the whole thing wakens. And it wakens in relationship. It's how we recognize our teachers. Something resonates, even though we couldn't quite say what it is. Something happens. And we begin to kind of wrestle with it for a long time. But also begin to feel what I was saying is that tender place, feeling that open up, that there's suddenly a possibility. Because we see it over there, we can feel that we ourselves are like that also. And it's offering, both sides are offered the opportunity to open up. It's not a one-way thing. It's a mutual thing, completely mutual. And sometimes it happens on one side, but not the other. It's okay. But the ultimate, you could say, or the essential, is when it happens on both sides.
Is it a continuous thing, or is it?
Yes, because once it happens with somebody, then you realize it's happening all the time, everywhere, with everything.
It's not literally having a meeting. It's that meeting that we talk about.
Yes.
That you can talk about forever.
Yes. The untalkaboutable meeting. Mary Ellen?
I was wondering, Buddha rejected the most austere type of practice. In his day, what did he recommend to his monks? What was he advocating? What did he really come to? How much did he... What was he suggesting in a practice 1 hour a night you slept, or what did he bother you to?
He didn't talk in terms of time that I know of at all. He would just encourage people to go and find a tree. He would say, just go and sit under a tree and be there a while. Or a little hut. He would often send people out to make a little hut and just sit in there and calm down and find some kind of peace. And his monks, when they went out, I think they all sat quite a lot. There are several stories of him sitting all night with a shepherd. He would go everywhere. He would go to fancy houses and kings' palaces and in the most lowly shepherd's huts too. And he always brought zazen wherever he always brought meditation wherever he went as his gift to people. But I don't think he ever set a time, at least that I know. Do you know, Dan?
I haven't heard of that, although another struck me in your question was, for example, at one point he was trying to do an ascetic practice involving food, and he was down to, I think you mentioned it, was one piece of rice a day or something.
Yeah.
And he realized that kind of bodily torment is that's not the practice. And he gave up on that and went back to eating regularly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's found somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah.
My son went to spent several weeks in Japan living with a Japanese family between his junior and senior year of high school. And part of the curriculum of the student that he was visiting was to go to a monastery overnight and spend some time there. Mm. And he had no idea what the practices were or anything. So the practice was to hold your bowl out, and it was filled with rice. As long as you held the bowl out, it would be filled with rice. And then when if you wanted it to stop, you brought the bowl in. He had no idea. And here he is, new chopsticks. You could kind of brand new. And so he, and then the egg practice that he later found out was that you had to eat everything.
Yes, yes. Yes.
And they all had to wait until they came.
That's terrible.
It was mortifying. It seemed to take forever. He didn't know if he would ever pick up any of the grain with his tiny little chopsticks.
Yes.
So that was the story that one of the stories.
Yeah, it's like that. I've been there. Sometimes they give you, it's not even really rice, it's a rice soup that you're supposed to eat with chopsticks. It's awful. Yeah.
I always love reading, kind of rereading these sections, and when he talks about the way or some practice to think, kind of rewrite it as your life. So the two lines that came to mind is, he says, you sat together with the elder in the monk's hall. There was no relaxing even for one night. And if you kind of rewrite it under that interpretation, it's like you sat with someone who's seen the way of their life. They were encouraging us to do the same.
Hmm.
It's like it isn't that it's being held from you. It's there.
Yeah.
And I can personally testify to this, you can often feel separated from your own life. And all you have to do is be yourself.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's incredibly hard. And he's saying, how can you can't relax. It's your life. You want to be who you are, fundamentally.
Yes.
And yet we're often not.
Yeah.
So that, to me, rewriting and rereading it that way. And I've done this with everything from the Heart Sutra to other, Dogen things. It's amazing how you see that again and again, that motif.
Just comes back to this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just this. Yeah. I remember when I first met Koban, and I just walked into the Zendo where they told me he was. They just said, there's a teacher in Los Altos on University Avenue in this little suburb, this little suburban neighborhood. And I'd already been to Tassajara, so I knew how to sit. I had seen Suzuki Roshi a couple of times and been very impressed, but when I saw Koban, and he was sitting across, I was sitting at the far end of the room, tiny little room, and he just looked at me and I looked at him, and that was it. Well, no, actually it wasn't. No, it took a lot longer for the meeting. lot longer. It's still going on. Yes.
What were you aware of when you were with him?
That he was willing to see me. I think that's what it was. It was like he gave me permission to be what Dan was talking about, to just be who I am, not anything else. And that was his gift. He was that way with everyone. It was wonderful. And it meant so much to me. It really kind of saved my life. And then it was years and years, actually, of practicing together and trying to understand what was going on. You know, it's a very mysterious process, really. There's a lot of things happening, and then a lot of empty space, and your whole life going on at the same time. There was one point during Sesshin in Hidden Villa after, I don't know, some years, and I was supposed to have interview with him, a Dokusan, and we walked up the hill together, and I had a cup of hot tea, and I don't know why, I handed him the tea and asked him if he wanted some, and he accepted and drank it and then gave it back to me, and I drank it, and it was like a completely spontaneous thing, where it was one cup of tea and one mouth, you could say, and one belly. That was part of it. And it was that I had the courage to do that. It was kind of up to me to make some kind of step in that. And I didn't think to do it. It just all came together at that time. Well, it's just about 8 o'clock. Is there anything else? Julian?
Maybe it seems like another aspect of the passage is like the idealization of practice itself. Like, do you have any other words about, like, I don't know, like signs of when that is going on, or...
When people are getting too extreme, you mean?
I guess, yeah. Like, I mean, it seems pretty obvious. I mean, getting too tired where you can't sit, that sounds...
Yeah. Well, in this kind of practice, sometimes you have to find you always have to find your own limit. And it's usually a lot farther than you think it is. So... You can get totally obsessed, of course, and just make it a kooky kind of thing. But if you're really serious, then you can see where it takes you. We don't know. You know, every time we sit, we really don't know what's happening, what's going to happen. We just offer ourselves to it. And... learn a little more every time.